I'm the cat with the bass and drum, going around like bum bum bum.
Right then, let's have a go at this. A little idea that's grown into a reality between the three of us. What we're going to do, each of us is going to find a story from the week in sport, bring it to the conversation, and we'll see what happens from there. As many tangents as we like, no scripts, just raw opinions based on what's been going on in the world of sport. So, no delays, straight in. Jimmy, what's next?
I, off the back of Liverpool this week, and everyone saying that they've now gone however many games unbeaten since Crystal Palace beat them, was it 2016? The focus solely being on where do they rank in the Premier League, but then also in terms of football and other sporting teams, where do they rank there? Now, I won't be able to branch much into it, but you think of, you ever seen the film Moneyball?
Yeah,
what a belter.
Unreal. But away from that, how that team goes on their however many game unbeaten run that was then, I think, eventually beaten by, was it the Red Sox? I could be coming up horribly naive here.
Could be the Red Sox that beat them, but it was the Oakland A's that it was based on.
Yeah. So then looking at teams and their records that they've done, and obviously from common knowledge in the Premier League, you think of Arsenal's Invincibles, Man United's Treble Winners, Man City's 100 Centurions, Newcastle's Entertainers. They didn't win anything, so they're going to fall very short in this conversation, but we'll throw them in there. Leicester City and winning the Premier League back in 2016 when they did. How do Liverpool at the minute rank amongst the Premier League all-time teams and sport in general?
See, I like this as a question on the basis that I always get quite annoyed when people defend Arsenal's unbeatables, because I don't think they would finish top four in the Prem at the moment as it stands.
Right, you're about to get very rattled by me then. I love Arsenal's Invincibles.
Don't get me wrong, I love them. Perez, Henri, get them all in. And they'd make most Newcastle teams that I've spent my life watching, but I don't think they'd finish. Because of the number of games that they drew, even that game against Portsmouth where they were almost protecting a draw against lowly Portsmouth, I don't think they would be as successful in the modern era.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, times have changed in the way that you look at players. I was looking at this earlier. I've watched a bit more of that all or nothing Man City in the last couple of days. And what fascinated me is how much money they've spent on really pony centre-backs. They've spent a combination of 80.55 million on Mangala and who was the absolute donkey that they've just sold to Benfica?
Otamendi.
Otamendi.
Yeah.
Spent 80 million on those two.
Do you not think, with going back to the Arsenal Invincibles and then some of the Man City signs and then even some of the other Premier League signings of good teams, that the recruitment is purely based on luck for most people? Because Man City could have come across one of the best centre-halves by spending 5 million, like 9 million when they got Vincent Kompany. But then they spent 30 million or whatever it was on Mangala, 32 million, and it was meant to be the next best thing to make them as good as the Invincibles of Arsenal, but it was absolutely pony.
Yeah, and in a way you look at that, but I think also coming back to that era of team where Arsenal went unbeaten, and if you're going to support Doyle's point of view in a way, what I would say is Newcastle, who were sort of in and around the top five at the time, had a centre-back partnership with Jonathan Woodgate, who was brilliant, and then obviously went on to be a Real Madrid player. But they also had him partnered with either Andy O'Brien, Titus Bramble, Nikos Dabizas would have been in and around there at that time. And all I'm saying is, nowadays, you look at someone else who's just outside the winning the title. Chelsea, for example, who played Newcastle. Antonio Rudiger cost 30, 40 mil for Chelsea. And he's not even in the picture for them anymore. So all of a sudden, I'm pointing out that I think teams are better, but also defenders are better at other teams now. So if you're supporting that point of view, players like Henri, Bergkamp, they were doing it against... No disrespect to those players. I'm obviously playing at the top level and I'm sat in my bedroom recording a podcast with my two pals on a Wednesday night doing absolutely fuck all of his life selling bricks. But they're not at the established like sort of level that I think a Premier League player is now. I think the level has gone up as the money's gone up.
But where, realistically, where do you think that Invincibles last season, not this season, last season, where would that Invincibles team have finished?
Well, when Liverpool won the league or when City last won the league?
We'll go both. Last season when Liverpool won the league and the season before when Man City got 100 points.
Well, if you look at points that they finished on, you've got to say that they wouldn't have won the league in either case.
Yeah,
Liverpool,
but
there were seven games to spare. And I don't think their style of football would have changed considering who would have been in that against that Invincibles side. They're still playing bomb it forward and just be rapid on the counter-attack. And I think, like you say, to get 100 points in the league was ridiculous. Liverpool finished second there with a what would have been record points and then win it with seven to go. That Liverpool front three, or front four as it could be now with Jota, running at Kolo Touré and Sol Campbell would be frightening.
But I think if you go the other way and you look at Liverpool nowadays, I don't think that Arsenal team back then of 04 when they went invincible is too dissimilar to what you see in Liverpool at the minute. The fullbacks absolutely bomb on and get up the pitch, which Ashley Cole and Lauren did at the time.
Yeah.
You had an absolute powerhouse in centre back in the form of Sol Campbell, which is your Van Dijk as such.
Yeah.
You had Kolo Touré, who was lightning quick for a centre half. And then in front of that, you had Patrick Vieira, who's your Jordan Henderson, your Fabinho, your playmaker. So I don't think they're too dissimilar.
Player for player, if you did a combined 11 between that Invincibles team...
But this is the thing. A lot of people have done this, haven't they?
And the current 11 from Liverpool. I would argue City's 100 team as well, how many players make from that Arsenal team make that team?
In the top there, for me, the two that would go straight would be Vieira and Henry. But then after that, I'd be looking at the other two teams, really. And Thierry Henry would go in as a striker, and Salah and Mane would still be the two.
I think you'd have Ashley Cole at left back ahead of Robertson. I think you'd have Bergkamp would drop into that midfield because I think he would be good enough to. And then you say to him, right, you've got that freedom to push up the pitch a little bit.
Play behind.
You take one of their centre backs to play alongside Van Dijk.
Jens Lehmann's not getting in.
Yeah, no, Jens Lehmann unfortunately miles out the pitch.
Poor lad, he's a nice guy, but
he's a lovely lad.
He's not getting in front of Alistair Edison, is he?
Play the ball at your feet.
But I mean, at the same time, the style of play isn't too different. If you think that Arsenal team back then was almost everyone's second team, they're not the ball around, they passed it, they moved. It was entertaining football to watch at the time.
Who was the better footballing team, Man City's 100-point team or the Invincibles? Who played the better football?
You've got to say Man City for the number of goals they scored. Man City that season broke records for number of wins in total, number of consecutive wins, number of goals scored, number of points.
Well, until I got to the point that Doug was saying about when they then realised that they were trying to go invincible, were Arsenal not playing that kind of football?
What, when Arsenal went invincible?
Yeah, because then once it got to that point of them being, oh, we're nearly at this, they started to play more defensive and take a draw against Portsmouth to stay invincible. But before that, they must have played some decent football.
Yeah, they played some very good football. But I think if you were to look at it from a different point of view, I think Man City lost to Liverpool in the January, didn't they? So all of a sudden, that worry of going unbeaten was out the window. Yeah. And I mean, Liverpool last season lost to
Watford
in the February. So I think, in a way, it almost freed the shackles of going into those final games thinking, oh, what if?
Yeah.
I mean, you think what you would say is the top managers, and when you watch the Man City All or Nothing documentary, Guardiola talks about Barcelona and Bayern Munich when they've won the league, losing those final games of the season because the players have switched off. There's nothing to play for. And he kept them motivated with focusing on 100 points. And what you would say is Klopp and Guardiola are good enough managers to keep them switched on and motivated by going unbeaten. Yeah. Probably a bit like Wenger did. The league's won. Let's go unbeaten now. And if it means seeing out a draw against Portsmouth, it shouldn't be how you play, but it is. And sometimes teams can surprise. I mean, when Man City scored 100 points, their second last game of the season was Huddersfield at home, who were fighting for survival and they drew 0-0.
Yeah.
So... Yeah. By that measure, you can't just look at it and say they went out and got a draw. Man City are the most attacking team that I think the Premier League's seen. And even Huddersfield that season, who were fighting for their lives at the bottom, managed to get a draw at the Etihad.
Yeah.
So
Yeah. All right, we'll take it out of football, like you're saying. There's all the football teams. So I think the Liverpool team, the Man City team, and the Arsenal team, probably is a fair argument to say that they're pretty much on par with each other.
The Man United treble team's absolutely fallen out of this conversation, which is, I'm not asked because I hate Man United. But you can't overlook it when you think of how good they were. Scholes.
I suppose you go back to even Mourinho's Chelsea team, though.
Yeah. I can't remember. Did they set records at the time?
They scored the most goals, didn't they? Not in the season, but they were. They started flying, didn't they? And then when they won the league, they were miles ahead of everyone. They didn't break any records, but they were certainly, at that time, they were better than everyone else by a country mile. I think that's probably why it stands out to me.
They were the first of that big money spending era as well, weren't they?
Yeah. I think what they did so well was, a bit unlike Man City, they got the money and went and won the league immediately.
Yeah.
Whereas Man City had to build on it and probably had 3-4 years of consolidating before eventually winning the league.
Well, Chelsea had a few good had decent players anyway, didn't they? They had a good squad, whereas Man City were literally pony and went and signed Rubinho on millions just to attract other players to come.
Yeah, but it was that signing that didn't even make sense in the end. If you think of the spine of the Man City team that's been successful, Kompany was there before the money. David Silva was signed in the summer of 2010 after the World Cup. Toure was signed the same year. Aguero came a year later. Tevez was signed before that. So,
yeah, true.
I think in a weird way, I mean, City's money has been, I think if you did a breakdown of City's most successful players compared to money that they've spent elsewhere, the vast amount of money, and this could be true about any club, I suppose, but the vast amount of money that City have spent on players probably falls into the flop category rather than club success, cult hero, won trophies.
Yeah, they've not had many people they've spent massive money on stay. They've had a couple, obviously, but they've had a lot of people they've had to then go and look for a second or third replacement for.
Yeah.
It took them, I mean, if Laporte's their best, and I mean, we'll yet see how good this Ruben Diaz is, but it took them however many attempts to find Laporte.
Yeah.
And they still can't quite find his partner yet, because we're not sure how good Ruben Diaz is yet, but...
Thinking of streaks, so obviously that the winning streak at Anfield and things that Liverpool had, rather than it being a team-based thing, how good was Jamie Vardy's goal-scoring streak in a footballing sense when he broke Van Nistelrooy's 10 and he went 11, Vardy, with his goal-scoring as an individual? Obviously, that was in a title-winning team, it turned out, but I think he did it over sort of Christmas time. As an individual... in a team sport, how good a record is that in comparison?
I think that could top it.
Yeah.
I genuinely do. So coming from, if you look at where he came from in the sense that he scored his first Premier League goal at the age of 28, or maybe a bit younger, 27.
His story is phenomenal.
The year before, and I think at the end of that season, I was watching, oddly enough, the Premier League 100 Club the other night, and he was on it. And I think at the end of that first season, 2014-15, when they just avoided the drop, he scored 4 goals all year. And then all of a sudden, obviously got the 20 the following year, or however many he got in that title-winning season where he scored 11 in a row.
Yeah.
And then he broke 100 this summer, didn't he?
Yeah.
It was just in the lockdown, wasn't it?
So I think to go from non-league playing for Fleetwood Town to sign for Leicester in the Championship... Not even, I mean, the other one that I think back to is that game against Watford where Knockout missed the penalty and Deeney scored the winner.
In the playoffs?
Yeah, at the other end. Because day on their bench, Leicester had Vardy, Harry Kane and Chris Wood.
Yeah, yeah.
Obviously two of them are in the 100 Club and Chris Wood is an established Premier League centre-forward for them.
Yeah,
I think all of a sudden you look at that and that makes his rise even better than he was behind David Nugent, he was behind Joe.
Yeah.
He said his favourite partner to play front with was David Nugent. Who he plays with? Out of everyone, they asked him who's your favourite strike partner. He's like, oh, David Nugent.
You think about it in a way. I mean, certainly at his time at Leicester that I remember, that first season he had David Nugent up front. And even then he wasn't guaranteed to start. They had, as I said, Ujoa. The second year it was Okazaki. but he almost dropped in and played a number 10 role. And since then, Vardy's very much been a lone striker in that role.
Yeah.
Play Maddison in behind, they have Mahrez in behind sometimes, but he's never had a out and out partner. He's not going to turn around and say Islam Slimani.
Well, he never done.
He was good at Newcastle, though.
Spooky that he's still playing for Leicester, by the way. Forgotten man.
Well, in terms of that, then, if that's a goal scoring record, obviously Friedel has the appearance record, which I think, as a goalkeeper who's half decent, respectable in the Premier League side at the bottom end, is a great record at 310-ish or whatever. What about Peter Cech's at the other end in goal for his clean sheet record for a season? And then I think Van der Sar's got the most in a row. I think Cech's got 24 in a season.
Yeah.
And Van der Sar is 14 in a row. Is 14 in a row clean sheets better than scoring 11 in a row?
Not in context of the two teams they play for. I know Leicester won the league. I know Leicester won the league, but at that time, obviously, that run of Leicester winning the league could have come to an end, and Vardy more or less kept it going with his goals, I suppose, through that period, which is obviously quite a difficult period through Christmas.
Both
I
think when you take the ten, Van der Sar won the league in that year because it was 08-09. I've just looked.
But compared when you take that 10 that were behind Jamie Vardy supplying him, and I mean, some of them have gone on to have great careers. If you think Mahrez moved for 60 million to City, and N'Golo Kante has been in every world team of the year pretty much since.
And Danny Drinkwater season. Got his big move to Chelsea.
Danny Drinkwater's a £35 million footballer, terrifying. But you think that they had Mark Albrighton on one wing. They had fullbacks of Danny Simpson and Christian Fuchs supplying him.
Yeah.
I think all of a sudden to then look at what Van der Sar had in front of him, you've got to say that what was better.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
I don't necessarily disagree. I just think it's sometimes, obviously, strikers get a lot of the credit. There's the 100 club there, but there's not necessarily a 100 clean sheets club celebrated quite as much. But,
no one pays money to go watch a goalkeeper, Andrew.
Well, you say that. You say that.
I used to worship Shay Given as a youngster, actually.
Still got a shirt signed in the office up there. What about non-football in that sense? So I had a couple that sprung to mind when we mentioned this. And my initial thought straight away was Floyd Mayweather and his unbeaten boxing record that he's managed to get to 50-0, which is, I would say, on the basis that they've just announced a lot of people talking about unbeaten records, and obviously Canelo Alvarez lost to Mayweather in that record. They've just announced the Callum Smith fight, and a lot of people talked to him as him being the pound-for-pound king, which Mayweather undoubtedly probably was. I think his record in sport, Calzaghe was unbeaten. There's obviously a few others. Is it Rocky Marcantonio Marciano? He was unbeaten as well. There's a few featherweight guys who fight at lower weights. But I think for me, sporting unbeaten runs or achievements and records, to go and stand in a ring for 12 rounds, because the majority of his fights were world title fights for Floyd Mayweather, to go 50-0 is probably worth being up there in a conversation.
You can't dispute it.
He has to be up there in the conversation. I think from my point of view, and this is biased because I don't like Floyd Mayweather, you'd say that he avoided his opponents at their peak.
Yeah.
But I think that's the same for any boxer. I mean, even someone like Joshua, who I do quite like, will not commit to fighting Wilder or Fury. Whereas you look at someone like Fury, who went out of his way and said, right, I'll go to America. I'll go over there and I'll fight him. If he's at the peak of his career and he thinks he's the best, I'll go sit him down.
Well, just having a little bit of a look at Mayweather's record, which was his 50-0, and his 50th was obviously Conor McGregor. And he's still talking about going over to Japan, in Asia, to fight someone to get to 51-0 in an exhibition fight, just so he can pad his record out. His 49th, which broke the record initially, I think, was Berto, who was a nobody at that point. And his 48th was the payday against Pacquiao, which, as you say, Pacquiao was well past it. He's then had two fights before that against Marcos Maidana, who struggled to make any weight. And then it was Alvarez, which everyone will stand there and say now, wow, Canelo, what a great win. But when you look at it in the context, Canelo would have been low 20s at that stage fighting with a fighting IQ, which is nowhere near what he's fighting now when he's actually in his prime. And you've obviously got to remember he's taking on Shane Mosley, Ricky Hatton, De La Hoya, all probably just past their prime, a fraction. Still at world title level, but not on the rise, probably on the decline or peaking, to pad out that record. So I think still, to be fair, standing there for 50-odd fights with someone trying to knock your head off is a decent enough record to go unbeaten. But he will always be accused of being the best defensive boxer of all time rather than the best ever because of his aggressive style. But
well, I mean, he did sit down Hatton. And again, I was probably a bit too young to really appreciate that fight at the time, but Hatton was still in good condition. Like, at least I knew when he was fighting Hatton that Hatton was a little bit closer to his peak than Pacquiao was when he fought him.
Hatton had just had his big win against Postatizer, hadn't he? So he went out there and he took 20. The big thing about that fight was he took 20-odd thousand fans with him. So Mayweather, albeit being in America and Vegas, almost had an away fight because of how many Brits and mad Mancurians went across with Hatton for his Winter Wonderland. And that was, to be honest, the first of the big fights I really remember enjoying, because I remember the press train around that and things like that, where there was press conferences around the world.
You know what my build-up to that was that I remember? I watched Floyd Mayweather on MTV Cribs.
and then Shola Ramiobi.
Here's me hats. And I remember, I think it was my brother at the time, I was saying, oh my God, look at that house, that's amazing, like, what a bloke this is. My brother's like, nah, he's a dick, he's about to fight Hatton. And I remember that being the standout thing for me, like, oh my God, Floyd Mayweather on MTV Cribs, like, he must be a baller.
As you can see, I love me caps. The only other one that I could think of, and there's millions more in sports that I'm probably not particular fair with, especially when you go across America, and if you were to look at NFL or if you were to look at baseball, etc., in more detail, I'm sure there's some long streaks going on there. But the two that came to mind, purely because I looked at them because it was on the news earlier on, was Nadal's 53 straight wins on clay at the French Open, and Federer's 23 straight Grand Slam semi-finals to be in the last four. Now, I think Nadal's straight wins on clay tips the 23 Grand Slams purely on the basis there's four good tennis players in the world, as an outsider's opinion. I'm sure there's not, but I think...
Yeah, the likelihood is that you're going to... If you're one of those four, you're going to get the semi-final.
You've got a decent chance. So to do it 23... Had it been 23 Grand Slam finals in a row and you're in the last two, well, I think... I mean, to get to the last four is pretty impressive anyway, don't get me wrong, but... to be unbeaten 53 in a row and make one surface your own, for me, that record on clay. But then it's the same thing, isn't it? If you said to Liverpool, right, you can only play at Anfield, Nadal only plays on clay, both are as good as each other in terms of their home environment, so to speak. Yeah. All of a sudden you put Nadal on a hard quarter on grass. Yes, he's obviously still successful, but he's not that successful to the same level. But I don't know what is the most successful. If someone won, remember Jordan Spieth a couple of years ago in the golf, won the Masters and the US Open back to back, and everyone thought he was going to win all four in a year, when Tiger's probably won tournaments back to back to back to back, or won major. He had the career Grand Slam held at where he held all four majors in a row. Is that a more substantial individual achievement than either of those two tennis ones? I don't know. It depends on the sport and the fields.
Well, there was that stat, wasn't there, when Dustin Johnson won the Masters? He's the first number one to win a major since Rory McIlroy in 2014 when he won the PGA.
Not won for 6 years,
So all of a sudden, I think you look at something like, and that's not to take away that I'm not saying Dustin Johnson's one of the all time great sports stars. He is, he's done very well for himself, but he's not won the numbers that Tiger's won. He's not won the numbers that...
Even Phil Mickelson or someone's won,
And then, I mean, you look at the greats, you look at you, and I've had a mind blank and now I look like a bit of a fool trying to think of Jack Nicklaus and...
Nicklaus, Palmers,
Players, yeah, exactly. So all of a sudden...
Byron Nelson,
even your Nick Faldo, he's not won the numbers that Nick Faldo won.
Yeah, no, six, absolutely.
So
The only team I can think of, or record, was... was the Aussie cricket team that won 22, went on a 22 unbeaten streak of ODI games from 2005-2008.
What is, not trying to highlight anything here, purely because I was listening to it the other day, what's the current Aussie women's cricket streak at?
22 as well, I think.
Is it the same? Yeah, so they got one to break that men's.
Then they've got, I heard that the other day as well.
I saw, I think it was on Grey Cricketer or something. But
the reason I bring that is obviously when I looked at it earlier, because I knew it was just above 20, they won something along the lines of 78 within that time period of the time they played it. That same team, because they pretty much kept the same team for the two, won around 78 tests out of 93. So I know it's not an unbeaten record, but is it a case of how hard it is and difficult it is to win and as a team in cricket? Is that team up there as well as the individual performances?
I think it depends what format you were looking at. I think if you were to say ODI, it's so unpredictable in a way, because you've got to be so consistent. Like, you'll know yourself playing cricket, that you've got to be so consistently on it to win a game. And you've got to dominate. Certainly, I would say two of the three aspects in order to win.
Yeah.
And I think all of a sudden for you to turn around and say that, winning 23 or 22 games was impressive, I think. I don't know. Maybe it's me being quite critical of it. I would have said if they'd done that in test matches, then I'd hold my hands up and say it. But I almost think an ODI, when all of a sudden a draw's ruled out and it is literally win or lose, but then you'd say that it's the same with football.
Yeah, I think it was just something that the one that came to head, because I knew I'd heard about the women's.
What's the All Blacks? The All Blacks were
18 in a row.
But what's their stat about Eden Gardens, or is that entirely based on like England or a British team being over there? If that makes sense.
Oh no, one of them there. Is that not the thing that was from the Lions tour that went across, and they drew there, and that was their worst result in not far off a decade at that
moment, sort of
daft like that. They were talking about it the other day when I was watching the England-Ireland game, which was on as part of this Autumn Nations thing, because Argentina beat New Zealand last week and then drew with Australia this weekend. And they were talking about that New Zealand's sort of effectively turning it round to turn and put the heat on Argentina this weekend, and sort of saying they won't stand for a loss, let alone a draw. They'll try and win it by 15-20. And I think it might have been at that same venue that you're talking about.
Well, I mean, I'm looking at it now and it says, in over 100 years, Eden Park has been considered the hardest place in the world for teams to beat the All Blacks. 86 test matches, the All Blacks have lost only 10 times.
I mean, not only is that a freakish record, but it also shows how good they've been for such a long period of time without having ebbs and flows.
So all of a sudden, I think you'd almost throw the All Blacks into that record as well. But you think of that. Even the South African victory at the last World Cup, I wouldn't have considered them to be favourites going into it. New Zealand were obviously
New
Zealand were playing well at the time. They would have been up there. I think South Africa and how powerful and aggressive they were almost took everyone a bit by surprise. So it'd be interesting to see how they play over the next couple of years to see if they can maintain that.
What's really nice is that South Africa have won the World Cup. Obviously, there's been this pandemic going on. They won the World Cup over a year ago and they've not played a game since. They're reigning and defending, and they haven't had to even show anyone. They haven't had to play in England. They haven't had to play. They've pulled out the rugby championship and things like that. So they are purely holding on to their schoolboy rules of...
Can't be unbeaten if you can't play us.
we're unbeaten in 3.5 years, but we've only played a game.
Oi, Mayweather, I've got the title. Come and take it off me, but I dictate the terms.
Yeah.
I might see them do it on a cold, wet, windy night at Stoke. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, there's some good ones.
I was just trying to think of like any of the sports that you can consider. And like, as you said there, you made a good point with the Australian women's team. I mean, who's dominating the women's football at the minute in England? Arsenal got quite a decent team, Alex. I see that Ian Wright's tweeting about it every day.
Mm-hmm. What's the American women's football team? They must have a record. Even if it's winning World Cups or won fixtures in a row, they must have some sort of substantial record, I would have thought, because they're phenomenal.
They're so good.
Yeah, and they carry or they get more funding than the American men's team. Poor Josie Altidore is struggling to win a wage out there because it all goes to the woman.
USA women's football record. I actually want to see what this is, because that is a good record. They're one of the top teams, which is a bit surprising that all of a sudden the US women's can be so successful. But as you said there, the US men's being led by Jose Altidore. They've got a couple of decent players who are playing over in Europe, but in all honesty, the MLS is poor. It's
a strange thing.
It's going for a pay packet before they hang out the boots and call it a day, and they're not getting the peak. I mean, if you look at some of the players I've had over there, David Villa, Henri, Kaká, Robbie Keane, to name a few, Beckham.
Mm-hmm. Well, you talk, the conversation we had the other day off camera was about briefly Bradley Wright Phillips being the best striker they've ever had over there, and he could barely make Championship League One sides over here. Goes across and he's absolutely lauded across there. So that is the level of football across the board. But the men's football, that must come from their college sports setup. All the male college athletes that go there are there purely for your American football dream, your NBA dream, your baseball.
Yeah, so in a way, do you think it's funding?
Yeah,
so do you think all of a sudden, because there probably isn't the funding from the NBA, the hockey leagues, the NFL for women's sport, all of a sudden there's more push from soccer to get in there? And because the American women have been so successful, they've got a platform to build on for that in the colleges.
Yeah, I'd have thought so. I don't know what I'm saying in terms of official figures, but I imagine looking at those sports, because there's an NFL draft straight out of college, there's an NBA draft straight out of college, there's a Major League Baseball draft straight out of college, those sports are the ones that are funding the programs massively. I think there is an MLS draft style, but if you're already at best fourth sport, all your natural athletes have already gone to something else where there's a bigger payday out there.
Yeah.
And as you said before, with someone like a Pulisic, if you're a good American footballer, you're trying to get out to a German or a Premier League or an Italian academy at 16, 17. You're not waiting until you've completed a college degree at 21 to try and make it.
I mean, what's weird in a way is I think there's a lot of kids in England that probably have got a footballing dream still that haven't realised it in the UK. So then go out to America for college and almost go the other way, seeing it as an easy route in. And coincidentally enough, linking it back, I was listening to Cy Ferry doing an interview with Barry Ferguson. And Barry Ferguson was saying that his son, who's 18, has just gone over there and he was doing, I don't know how long ago it was recorded, but at the time he was 6 months into his first semester.
Right, yeah.
And the view was that he's gone over there to play football. He knew he wasn't going to make it in England. So I think it was, well, I'll get a degree when I'm over there. It'll benefit me for the future. I've got one final shot at it. And at the very worst case, I'm living in a different country, experience a different culture, and having a good laugh along the way.
I don't think it matters what sport it is out there. If you're playing college sport in America, whether that's college wrestling, whether that's college football, whether that's college soccer, baseball, you are treated like a professional athlete. And although you're not getting paid for it, the facilities and the program and fixture program that is put in place for you.
Well, you think of some of the golfers who have been over there and done it, and listening to the Masters, they're constantly talking about what college they were at. And, who was the... Was it Casey or was it Casey that was at Chicago?
Matt Fitzpatrick was at Northwestern. Casey may well have been out there, but there's Wolf is just literally should still be finishing his college, and he has he's now playing his third major, nearly won two of them. All of them almost certainly carry some sort of college badge on their bag somewhere. Ricky Fowler still wears his orange on a Sunday because it's his college colours. They all have this go, whoever pokes Tigers, whatever, to even if they left college years ago, there's still some tie. And as you say, a lot of the English guys have gone across there because that's the best programme that they can get, rather than turning pro at 17, 18 here and having to go through the small satellite tours. They go across to America.
Yeah, I certainly get that for the very top athletes, but I just find it interesting that almost you could look at it the other way. And as you said earlier, for British students going out to America to golf and Americans coming over to Europe to play football to chase a dream, there's almost that opposite where it's like the last chance at the dream, so to say. There's people that go out for one last pay packet, and it's not even just football. Well, soccer that they do it. You think of the rugby players, is it Marlon Yard that went out to play NFL?
Lawrence Okoye went across there. Alex Gray's just come back to play Bath. Christian Wade went across there to play NFL.
Yeah, so I've done Marlon Yard dirty there, but...
But even in rugby terms, now that the US rugby are trying to try and play, they're trying to develop this whole new sport thing. And Chris Robshaw has just signed a contract. He's retired from Quins and obviously England. And he's going out there to build American rugby, which will not be a cheap contract for him. So he's going out there for a couple of paydays to develop their sport. And they've just had Rugby X out there. Speaking of Marlon Yard, he hasn't blocked me on Instagram. He's one of the few celebrities that haven't. But every time he put up a party, so when I was still at school and school got to the Daily Mail final, he was part of the team alongside Elliot Daly that we watched at Twickenham. And he scored a hat-trick at Twickenham, watching a few of my friends play in the final, etc. And pretty much ever since then, every time he has posted a story on his Instagram, I reply saying, no Yardie, no party. And not that long ago, he replied to me saying, here, mate, shut the fuck up.
actually.
So that's my claim to fame with Marlon Yard. But no, he's not out in America, but he's a good lad.
He's got your number absolutely sorted.
No Yardie, no party.
Off topic again, by the way, did you see that they've announced the FIFA shortlists for their awards this year?
There he is.
Can't for the life of me quite work out.
First one, honestly, mate.
Honestly, mate. Can't for the life of me work out how Marcelo Bielsa's made the cut for the world's greatest coach.
Well, they think he'll be the replacement for Guardiola if Guardiola hadn't just signed us 2 years.
Well, it wouldn't surprise me, but at the same time, I'd look at it and say, yeah, he's a great coach, and obviously everyone bounces off him and says that they follow the Bielsa playbook as such, and Pochettino's talked about him. I think Klopp and Guardiola have both talked about him and how the view is he was almost like the founding father of coaching, and he's done wonders across Europe and South America, definitely. But to get promotion with Leeds United, to win the league with them, Leeds are the biggest club in the Championship at the time last year. Mm-hmm. I'm not denying his feat to get them up was obviously brilliant, but to put him as one of the best coaches in the world?
Well, I think it's an interesting topic of conversation, actually, and probably a whole other can of worms, so to speak. But Guardiola signing his two-year deal, I presume, is to win the Champions League and try and win one more Prem or whatever it might be in those couple of years, plus this one that he's got left. But if Bielsa is still in the Premier League with Leeds in 2 years, is that enough of an achievement to have kept them up for 2 years? Well, 3 years by then.
It depends what's backing is. Because I think at the same time, that's like a Newcastle argument with Bruce. And would you say, when people argue that, when people argue that Bruce and Benitez are the exact same manager, you say, well, you look at the funding Benitez had and his net spend and everything else and where he got Newcastle up to 10th and cementing a league position, albeit over two seasons only. If Bielsa gets the backing that Leeds would be stupid not to give him, then you'd argue that he should be qualifying for Europe and trying to break into the... Not break into the top six, break into the top eight and then challenge the top six in a way.
See, I would argue if in 2 years' time Leeds were back in Europe because they've given him the backing that I agree should be able to get, Bielsa would be daft to leave to go to City.
No, I agree with that.
But I think this is coming on the conversation of who's bigger, City or Leeds. And I would say Leeds.
Yeah, I think historically, absolutely. Like, there's no question about it. I just think in terms of... It depends, because managers decide at strange times. There's still all this talk this week about Klopp being the next Germany manager because Joachim Löw is going to get the sack because they lost 6-0. And you sort of think, why would he possibly jump ship now? But managers do go at strange times. And if he got them into Europe, would that be the time that he's got, right, I've done all I can do? And then,
yeah,
I don't know. But
yeah.
Klopp's a funny one. He almost walked away from Dortmund at a time when Guardiola was on top in Germany.
Yeah.
And it was almost like, well, I'm not going to beat him. I've taken this club as far as I can. We've made a Champions League final. We've won leagues. We've won cups.
Which is probably what will happen at Liverpool. Once another team comes around, like the Chelsea when they had Conte and he just took over for that one season. Once that happens, then it might be the exact same time that Germany need a new gaffer and then it's just like happy days and you go. Do you know what I mean? He's won everything he's going to win at Liverpool. He literally can't win anything else. So
the other thing I think is managers managers' motivation slightly different. Would they rather, is managing your country the same as representing your country as a player? Is it the peak of that? Or do they look at it and say, I've got the opportunity to either work with a team day in, day out, build a dynasty and say, at least I can implement my stamp on this? Or are you a bit like we spoke last week about Southgate not having enough time and needing the friendlies to get the team gelling again? Do you then say, well, I've not got enough time to work with them. I'd rather see players on a daily basis at a club than every 2-3 months on an international duty?
Arguably, is Klopp going to be able to get his way of playing football to Germany? I doubt it, because you've seen, when you hear the interview that Andy Robertson had, when it was his first day and he did the German time trial of what they call Klopp's kind of German time trial, and he spewed up on his first day. And Andy Robertson didn't get the team for 3-4 months because he just wasn't fit enough to do what Klopp wanted him to do. He's not going to be able to do that with the national squad, is he? So why would he risk everything he's done for Dortmund and Liverpool that could be a failure at Germany when he probably knows he's not going to do it?
International football is always different in the sense I was watching, I can't remember who this was about, and it almost links back to the greatest ever teams that you can talk about. Oh, I'll tell you what it was. It was a documentary on Cafu. And it was all about Cafu's rise to fame within Brazil and how at the time when he first broke in, he couldn't get a game at right back. So it was someone, Jorginho, kicking him out of the team and eventually got a game. And it was all focused on going into the 2002 World Cup. They brought in Scolari. And at the time, the crack was that Brazil were in turmoil. They obviously had this world-class team of Cafu, Ronaldo, Ronaldinho, Gilberto, who would have been playing for Arsenal at the time, and you think of that team. And then all of a sudden, they weren't going to qualify for the World Cup. They qualified for the World Cup. They won the World Cup. But coming back to Scolari as a coach, if he was able to settle that Brazil team to win the World Cup, why couldn't he do it at Chelsea? So Klopp, who has done it in the Premier League and has done it at Liverpool, under tougher circumstances, dethroning Man City, who everyone said was going to set a Premier League dynasty and go on to win league after league after league. How has he been able? I think he's good enough to make the step into international and still implement his philosophy on what is still a very good German squad, by the way.
On that then, is it easier to step from club rugby to club football to international football than it is to go from being an international football manager to a club manager? Is it easier to give up all that time with players or to learn how to spend all that time with players?
Yeah, I think that's a different view, isn't it? Because you've then, it's time management and how you work in that limited time that you got with them.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
And I suppose you're always going to have different players in your squad. I know you do. Klopp will always have different players in his squad, but realistically, he's going to have the bubble of 30 players. Whereas if he took over Germany, you're going to have 10 injuries at once. So he's got to get 10 new players in. So like pulling 10 kids in from the Liverpool Academy, he's then picking 10 players that aren't his first choice that he's now got to build up around the same thing as he's got to do, or he's been trying to implicate for however long. And the likelihood is that people who are a little bit older will pack in playing international football and he might be his linchpin in his team kind of thing.
Go on then. Seeing as we're on Liverpool, we'll move on then. Sean, you're Liverpool related with your point. So what's next?
What's next is just off watching the Liverpool game, obviously under Jim's of Liverpool breaking the record, how well James Milner played on in the last game against Leicester. And my kind of question or point is he one of the most underrated Premier League players that there is? Or is he overrated? Or is he just a decent Premier League footballer? And is there anyone else who's had a very similar career that he's just a bit of a handyman to have in your squad? And is there anyone that would do the job he does, but at that highest level of winning leagues, winning Champions League? Is there anyone else that's good enough to do the same thing?
Bobby Grabson could play centre midfield and on the wing.
And pool to a high level.
No, I do find that interesting. City released him on a free. I think that's the mad thing to take away from all this. The City turned around at the time, obviously having won 2 titles in 4 years like they had, and said, you're surplus to requirements, we don't need you here anymore.
Yeah.
And if you look at it, you'd say that he's maybe inside and outside the dressing room, certainly in some of the videos you see online, he's probably one of the main figures at Liverpool.
Yeah.
Leading on the pitch, leader in the dressing room. Probably a bit of just poly with everyone as well, and just keeps everything gelled and ticking over. So
Yeah, I don't know whether... I mean, he played 147 games in 5 years at City.
Yep.
Which is obviously kind of pre-Pep. But when I watched the Man City documentary and they signed Fabian Delph from Villa, and then Delph was the James Milner because he was playing left-back, right-back, centre-midfield. He was the loudest in the dressing room. It was like, well, he's never going to be... Delph is never going to be as good as Milner, but you let Milner go on a free and you spend however much on Delph. How's that? How did that... Man City got all this money, all the best recruitment. How did they let Milner go for nothing?
Well, I think what you got to remember is Guardiola wasn't at City when Milner left. That would be my first argument of it all. And that's not defending the decision to let him go. That's just saying that you can't really look at Guardiola, who also didn't sign Fabian Delph. So I think to look at their philosophies, because I think Milner would fit in Guardiola's style of play. And I think if Guardiola was in charge at the time, I think he'd be a good enough manager to see that you need a James Milner around. But I think back to when I watched James Milner when he played for Newcastle, he was a winger. And I think now, if you were going to pick one position in that Liverpool team that you wouldn't want him to play, it'd probably be wing.
Yeah.
Probably because of the way Liverpool play, he just doesn't have the legs for it anymore. But he was never like lightning quick at Newcastle. But he would have been a very good centre midfielder, a number 10, a reserve fullback who could drop in and play that. He was wasted back there when he was at Newcastle because he was one of our best players. But I think he suits there for Liverpool now because he's a grafter.
Across those 600 professional caps that he's had, give or take, in professional football with all those teams at Leeds, Villa, Newcastle, City, Liverpool, and England, obviously, there can't be many people with anywhere near that number of caps have played that many different positions. He's played pretty much both fullbacks, even this year for Liverpool.
Yeah.
He's played all across the midfield. He's played, as you say, as a 10. As far as I'm aware, I don't think he's played up front as a nine by himself, pretty much. But he's covering 60% of a pitch as a utility player, effectively.
Does this link back to the modern day sort of views on sport, though? I mean, without wanting to sound like Cy Ferry too much again, does he drink? Does he drink? Is he a bruiser? What's he like on a night out? No, he's obviously... He doesn't drink. He takes his health very seriously. And everyone says, when you listen, read articles about Liverpool, they all say James Milner tops the running statistics. He's the fittest at the club. And you think of someone else, I just throw in a name out there, Jermaine Defoe.
Yeah. Who
obviously, when he was at Sunderland, was late 30s, released by Tottenham, sent over to America because it was deemed his career was finished. And he came back to Sunderland and he was their best player, kept them in the league for however many seasons in a row, then got a move to Bournemouth, where obviously he was at surplus requirements again and sent up to Rangers, where he's still banging them in up there. So again, I think there's a lot to say for just keeping yourself fit and almost not going out boozing, partying. Yeah. I think James Milner is, there's that obviously account that takes the piss being like boring James Milner, but he's the model pro in a way.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of sports people out there that you could almost say that could almost take a leaf out of his book and would extend their careers by not saying at the top level by 5-10 years, but even at just extend their careers in any sort of level by 3-4.
Is he playing his best football now at the back end of his career under Klopp at Liverpool, albeit in probably the most successful team he's been in? Is he playing his personally best football now as he has done across his career?
I think from watching him, the fact that he can play, if he plays left back, you know he's going to perform. You're not worried about him. Do you know what I mean? You're not worried that he's playing at left back. If he plays right back, you're also not worried about that. Mm-hmm. If he plays centre midfield, tonight he's playing. So he played 3-4 days ago. Then he's playing Champions League game tonight at centre midfield.
Yeah.
In Klopp's team, he's going to have to, he runs around and he might not have the legs to sprint and be the quickest, but by all means, he'll probably cover the most distance. Is he playing his best football? You'd probably argue he is. Every time he plays, he's up there to be man of the match. I mean, him and Andy Robertson were the two that were picked for who were man of the match against Leicester. So he's probably playing his best football because he knows his limits a little bit more as well, but he also knows exactly how to play his football and exactly what Klopp wants. He doesn't want to run up the wing and whip it in like Trent. He just wants him to sit and do his job, defend well against Leicester's Harvey Barnes, essentially, who's
he was kind of good against Villa,
an absolute rocket.
Mm-hmm.
He was mint at Villa.
Continuation of that, then, of that question: if he's playing near his best football, is he, when he retires, which could well be a couple of years still yet, is he a Premier League legend?
Yeah, for the number of games he's played and what he's won. I mean, what's he won now? 3 league titles. How many League Cups? Certainly 1 FA Cup.
He must have a League Cup alongside that. I don't have his trophies.
Well, he's definitely won 1 League Cup. He's won the Champions League. 2-1. He's won the Champions League. He's a Champions League semi-finalist.
Won the world, the FIFA World Cup. I know that's not the biggest thing in the world, but he's got 60-odd caps, 61 caps for England. It's no...
I think he would. I think he'd go down. I think... Interestingly enough, I read an article about, and it's naive, I'm not trying to put them in the same bracket, but for what they did for their clubs, they are quite similar. The James Pearce, when he was at Newcastle, and what he was saying is he felt that his career was actually shortened because he didn't have one set position. So he said he didn't reach the top level because he wasn't going into training every day and working on one role. And he said one day at training, he'll be covering right back. The next, he'd be centre mid, he'd be centre back, he'd be left back. And his view was, had he just had one set position that he covered throughout his career, he could have played at the top level for a bit longer. Obviously, James Pearce left Newcastle and went to Wigan, which was in the Championship at the time, and never played in the Premier League again, whereas James Milner's done it over however long. So I think all of a sudden, Milner's then broken down that stigma as you don't need to have a set position to train in. You could almost be used as a, just go fill in there and do a job for me.
Yeah, I suppose the thing is, if you're a centre midfielder, it's like Fabinho, he just slides straight back into centre half and looks like he belongs there. I know he played there when he was slightly younger, but I suppose as a centre midfielder, you should probably be able to play in quite a few positions. I know Trent Alexander-Arnold was a centre midfielder, taught right back. Jamie Carragher was a centre midfielder who got turned into a centre
He's just got a footballing...
Who can do that.
He's just got a footballing brain. I think that's the important thing. He reads the game probably better than anyone at Liverpool. Maybe not anyone, but certainly as well as players like Henderson and Van Dijk. I think the only thing he needs to worry about is his legs eventually not being able to keep up with his brain. And I think the moment the players start running past him and he can't keep up with them, in that sense, that's probably the day his career's done. I think he's funny enough, still probably got a couple of years in him. But you think back, he broke a record as the Premier League's youngest goal scorer back in 2002 with Leeds when he scored at the Stadium of Light.
Yep. Speaking of Premier League midfielders, then, I agree. I think Milner probably will go down as a legend, but there's a big debate, or there was a big debate not that long ago when he retires, as to whether Gareth Barry goes down as a Premier League legend. He's obviously the Premier League leading appearances, 6-5-3. So Milner's not a million miles short of that. And I imagine, as you say, with Milner staying fit, he'll probably overtake that in the Premier League, having played since he was such a youngster at Leeds. But Gareth Barry, is he a Premier League legend on appearances alone?
So, funnily enough, I would have said no. Because my other argument would be, if you were talking about, as you said earlier, with the goalkeeper and how Brad Friedel holds the records for a goalkeeper.
Yeah.
My argument would be he's not one of the Premier League legends in terms of being a goalkeeper. But then, maybe that's just my naivety. If you think that he played for Liverpool, Blackburn, Spurs... He was at the top level quite a long time. Gareth Barry was the exact same. He was at Villa. He was Villa's captain at quite a young age. Broke through there. Cemented his place. Went to Man City. Won league titles in Man City. Played in the midfield alongside David Silva, Yaya Toure, Nigel de Jong, who you consider Premier League greats. Maybe not de Jong, but certainly the other two. Everton after that, was it?
Yep. Everton for the majority of his career and... had a spell at City, Barry, and then West Brom. He finished up, I think.
West Brom, yeah. So I think it's difficult for a holding midfielder to get the sort of reputation of being a great, if that makes sense. Like, Paul Scholes scored over 100 goals. Gerrard scored over 100 goals, so they'll go down as being great. Gareth Barry won more league titles than Gerrard. Made more appearances than Gerrard. Yeah. By that, I'd be interested to see what their international appearances are, because I bet Barry's one of these players that has snuck a lot more caps than you realise.
Just trying to find it.
Essentially, Barry did all the dirty work. When he went to Man City, he did the dirty work for the lads to go and do the Yaya Toure's, the David Silvers to do their thing, and he just had to sit back and do the kind of hard work, hard yards, and start things off, I suppose, but give it to the lads who were the creative ones who cost all the money, I suppose.
I think Barry probably does go down as a great. I think when I think of great, I almost think of would I pay to go and see them? So I think Yaya Toure, Scholes, Keane, Giggs, Shearer, Cole, Rooney. Yeah, you go pay to see them because they're entertainers. Gareth Barry wasn't really an entertainer as such, but based on the fact that a bit like a James Milner, he went from club to club and was that long in the Premier League without dropping out.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was going to be my follow-up question, but just on that, Gareth Barry, over a 12-year period, has 53 England caps.
How many did someone like Gerrard make, out of curiosity?
Well, if you think for a lot of that, he would have been the backup option to a Gerrard or Scholes. Gerrard was obviously 114. Scholes, as a midfielder in that same time, has 66. So he's only 10, 12 short of Paul Scholes.
Yeah. Scholes retired dead young, though, didn't he?
Yeah, because he couldn't get into that Lampard. But who would have been backup midfielders then, even? Carrick, maybe? Would he have had more caps than Carrick, who always got in? Yeah, 34 for Carrick over a 14-year period. So Barry, just by being around, got a lot of caps. But that was going to be my next question that you've just sort of started on. If he is or isn't, the Premier League's obviously been around 28 years now. 10 legends. 10 Premier League legends. Who would they be?
Well, what are you wanting? Like one from each almost position? Would you say 11 and make your legend team? Or would you say...
No. 10 Premier League legends. That Schmeichel? Yeah, I've got Schmeichel.
Ferdinand, Vidic,
Les or Rio. Harry.
What's that?
Les or Rio or Anton.
Les and Anton.
Les, Rio and Anton. So we're up to four.
I think that's quite an open-ended question, because I think you can almost name 10 goal-scoring legends if you think. Okay, better question. Would you have Vardy in that list?
Nope. My strikers. So again, I've kind of split it. I went Shearer, Henri, Bergkamp.
No Rooney? 200? Only other player to make 200 apart from Shearer?
To be honest, forgot about him.
Andy Cole?
John Barnes, put them all in. Get them
in. Let's get the band back together.
It's a hard question. I had Shearer and I had Cantona in there. I had Schmeichel as well.
Drogba.
Yeah.
Do people like Cristiano Ronaldo get in there?
Aguero.
No, Ronaldo's not in there.
Best. I think you've gone too small with 10. I think if you said name 100 Premier League icons, I might be a bit touch and go and looking at people like Johnny Evans. He's won the lot.
Well, one week when we're really short of content, that's what we'll go for. 100. So next week when we're really 100 short,
each. 100 each.
No, it's an interesting comment. Like, where does someone like a Milner, to loop back to where we started from, or a Barry even fit in?
Yeah.
As you say, I'm probably not paying to watch a Milner as much as I had a season ticket watching him pay for however long at St. James's. I'm not paying to watch Barry, but Cantona, Shearer, Henri, Giggs. Yeah, you can have my cash for them.
But. Yeah. I mean, it's a bit rich of us to say we wouldn't pay to watch a Milner in a day and age when I certainly remember going to a game where James Milner was on the wing and he had David Edgar playing behind him at left back.
Yeah.
So I feel if you went through that team against Man United that day in the 2-2, they'd had Scholes, Giggs, Rooney, Ronaldo, Berbatov, genuinely star-studded, you'd say, yeah, I probably would pay to watch them. But I get where you're coming from. Terry, Lampard, Gerrard, Xabi Alonso. Elegant players, you know, that you look at and you just think, they had time. Cesc Fabregas?
Well, supposedly Benitez wanted to sign Barry to replace Alonso. Massive rumour mill. That's just taken straight off the BBC gossip page. But that's what they say.
2007.
That's what they say. It sticks in my mind. I remember it now. But yeah, no, interesting.
I do find that. Premier League icons. I'm already thinking about what I'm going to talk about next week, and we've not even gone through the final third category of this week.
Shall I go with my third then?
Yeah, go on. Yeah, what's next? Yeah,
well,
that's going to get dead old, by the way.
I had a couple of options. I was thinking, I thought about the rugby. I watched a lot of the rugby purely because it was a Falcons and they were more successful than the Toon this week. And you got to watch a lot of it because they've copied the football model of having every game on TV and accessible, which I think will help rugby massively financially. But what I've actually ended up going with, I've gone north of the border purely because of my obsession with Scottish football at the moment, thanks to Si Ferry and his pals. And thanks to I Can Boogie with it being a chart topper and them qualifying, I can't look any further than Rangers. Rangers, they're going to win it all. They're 11 points clear. Celtic have got two in hand. It makes no difference. But Rangers there, James Tavernier, Stevie Gerrard. There's that awkward clip of him meeting the kit man for the first man. And he doesn't know whether to shake his hands or not. And that was before COVID. Steve Gerrard knows what he's doing. 11 points clear. They've only conceded 3 goals all year. 2 of them were against Hibs.
How many times have they got to play Celtic this year?
They'll end up having to play them 4 times, but they beat them 2-0. It was a walkover.
So, in essence, they only need if they can avoid defeating probably the next 2 old firms, you'd say it's theirs.
Keep your specky left-backs at Celtic. Makes no difference. my neck, my back.
My neck, my back, my club should sell Cole back.
Honestly, I can't see, but Rangers, I mean, they're flying in Europe. But I don't see how they don't win it all this year. Because
I just want to say, with the Europa League as well, that they're doing all right in that, aren't they? They haven't lost in that either.
I mean, yeah, and they've had tough fixes in there. I think they've been across in Portugal at Benfica and things like that. But the problem with the Scottish League is every game is potentially a slip-up, isn't it? It's a banana skin because they're expected to win every game, probably bar the old firm at Celtic Park now. And if they lose wherever they are on Saturday, I think it's actually the League Cup this weekend, so bad question. But say they go to a Motherwell, a Kilmarnock. If they don't win that 2-3-0, people are saying the slip started yesterday type thing. But Celtic are in disarray with Lennon. He's all over the shop. He should never have gone back.
But well, I was going to say that. Is this sort of resurrection of Rangers based entirely on Gerrard eventually getting the squad that he wants and playing the style of football that is proven successful at there? Or is it based on the fact that Celtic lost Brendan Rodgers, who, considering what he's doing at Leicester at the minute, you would say was a very good manager in, albeit not a great league, but with a very good Celtic team who are obviously better than anyone else in the field?
But that Rangers team is going through it, and just, I've got the starting 11 up from Saturday. Alan McGregor's played Premier League football. James Tavernier has played. Did he play
Premier League football? Premier League football.
Certainly a lot of Championship football. Connor Goldson at 27. You've got Leon Balogun. Barisic at left back is an international football. Scott Arfield should captain everyone. Ryan Jack in the midfield gets linked with everyone going.
You've Scottish got, international, isn't he?
Yeah. Ayodele Aribo is a Nigerian international. You've got Kemar Roof, who left Leeds as one of their top scorers. You've obviously got Defoe up there. You've got Morelos, who gets linked with Newcastle all the time. And you've got Ryan Kent, who has played and gets linked with a lot of people. And
we should highlight the fact that getting linked with Newcastle doesn't make you a good player, i.e. Joel Linton.
The one thing I will say this year is the point that you've made about Gerrard having the squad that he wants and them still being allowed to make 5 subs in Scotland.
I didn't know they could still make 5 subs. I think, interestingly enough, it comes a little bit back to Gerrard. Very few managers, with the exception of that I can think of, Mourinho, have come in and hit the ground running, like, in that sense.
Yeah.
I mean, Guardiola needed a year to get the fullbacks and the players that he wanted. Klopp needed a couple of years to build Liverpool into what they are now. Gerrard needed that up at Rangers. And it was even harder for Rangers, obviously, coming out of the recession that they're not the recession, fucking hell, the administration that they've been in, dropping down the leagues, coming back up, rebuilding themselves, having bang average players at a massive, massive club to get them out of that predicament back into the league. They then obviously had to go through the process of building their squad back to be able to compete with Celtic.
But they had the thing that Juventus when they went into not administration, but they got went down the league and all the players stayed at Juventus. Rangers, albeit a completely different squad to what it is at the moment, a lot of their players stayed. So they were always coming back up on the bounce straight away. So it was only ever a 2-3 year punishment. But I do think, looking at it, I think with five subs, as you say, if you've got the squad that you want, the teams that they have to play, just even looking through that table, Aberdeen will be okay. Hearts got relegated last year and they were one of your big four. You've got St Mirren, Livingston, Ross County, Motherwell, St Johnstone, Kilmarnock, Dundee. You're not batting an eyelid at them. You are taking 6-9 points, depending on however many times you play them, a year off them. And then you've got Hibs, Aberdeen, Celtic to worry about.
But they played Aberdeen and they beat them 4-0.
And yeah, then they take, and that's what I'm saying. They'll take all the
and then they took all the big guns off because, like you say, and they took five of their main players off because they were hammering them. It's like, well, we'll not get them injured, so we'll take five people off. Happy days.
And that's partly, I think, as much as it's brilliant for them doing well in Europe, they're not going to go to the late stages in Europe. I might be wrong, they might do. But if they get out the group stage, if they get knocked out by, say, one of the Champions League dropper outers, there's a chance they're only focusing on the league by February.
Yeah.
And the one concern that they've got on that point, though, is Celtic are out, aren't they?
Yeah, but Celtic haven't got... They've got to sign players at Christmas. They're stuck with the same bunch for a while. And unless they pull in, they're going to be 10 points behind them at Christmas.
But there's also... Celtic's best players have all already said they want to leave, haven't they? The two French lads, the striker and the centre midfielder, they both want to leave. And Lennon's basically turned around and said, well, then leave if they want.
I wasn't aware of that. The one thing that I would look at listening to these podcasts about Scottish football is, and the predominantly Celtic podcasts, they talk a lot about Celtic's failures in Europe compared to previous seasons. I mean, you think back to, 7 years ago they beat Barcelona?
Yeah. Was that Tony Watt?
Yeah, I think it might have been. But they had players like, they had Van Dijk, they had Stuart Armstrong, they had Fraser Forster in goal, for example. And then all of a sudden they're coming into what they are now and they're saying, well, we can't string two wins together in Europe anymore. So do you look at the success in Europe and say Celtic's inability to qualify for the Champions League, and albeit Rangers have done it in the Europa League, which is of a lesser standard, do you say that that's a sign of how the pendulum is swinging more in Rangers' direction at the minute, if that makes sense?
Does it not swing because if you're approached by Celtic and Rangers now, say Celtic and Rangers are going for the same player, if you're going to go up to Scotland, who would you rather play for? Celtic, Rangers, Lennon, Gerrard. I think some people won't want to go to Rangers and wouldn't want to play with Gerrard, but certainly Gerrard has more pull because you see the people he signs.
I think Gerrard's got more pull from a continental sense. I think certainly listening to these people talk about Neil Lennon when he was at Celtic, everyone raves about him. I never saw Neil Lennon as a player. I saw him as a manager who I didn't really like. I know him as the player that headbutted Alan Shearer's boot and threatened to get Shearer sacked as England captain. I think he's a bit of a bell, in all honesty, but that's just my opinion.
If ever you get a lot of spare time and get caught up in Scottish Twitter, just go and have a look at some of the debates going on currently amongst the Rangers fan base. Not only Gerrard v Lennon comparisons and all sorts of names getting called, but also their own debate of whether they want to win the league or Europe this year. Because as I say, they're winning everything in their heads at the minute. If you're a Rangers fan, you've not won the league because your greatest rival have won the league 10 years in a row, albeit you were out the division for two or three and half of the years you've been back in it, you've not really been a true contender, or you could potentially win the Europa. What are you taking?
It's difficult to say when you're not a direct fan in that situation.
Like you said, the obvious
pull is to say you've won a European Cup. And I think if you said to all the players, would you rather in the SPL or the Europa League, everyone would pick the Europa League. As a fan, I look at it from my point of view. If I sat and watched Sunderland win 10 league titles as a Newcastle fan, but either obviously Newcastle break that duck or go and win a title that's higher than the SPL and is something that Sunderland haven't won, if that makes sense. I know Celtic back in the day when European Cups were fun.
With the Lisbon Lions, yeah.
But we're now talking, we're past that point. I'm looking more at modern day rather than the history.
It's hard to look at it without putting a reality on it and know that winning Europe is going to be a hell of a lot harder for Rangers, and you sort of think that it's a pipe dream. But if this is an ideal world, does, if they win Europe or the Europa League, do they still attract players, or do people still look at it and go, I've got to go and play a year in the SPL and that football's not great for me?
I don't know, because I think the one thing that helps...
Does winning Europe attract players for them as much as it does, say, an English club if they win in Europe and you're attracting a player to play in the Premier League?
Does it not, some of the people that some of them have signed, or like your Van Dijks, do they not use it as a bit of a stepping stone to go and play in Europe, that they're not getting touted by the big lads? So they go, right, well, you know what, do I go and play for a relegation side team in the Premier League? Yeah. Like we'll say at the minute, West Brom, do I go sign for and play for West Brom, possibly get relegated in the Championship and look hopeless, or do I go and play for Celtic or Rangers, who've just won the Europa League, or they're in Europe, I get to play against some proper players, I do well, I get me big move to Liverpool or to Southampton, like in Van Dijk. Mm-hmm. Van Dijk then plays in a decent Southampton team and then goes 75 million straight to Liverpool. Is that not what draws people in? Like Ryan Kent probably could have gone and played for West Brom in the Championship, let's say, and have a decent season, but then he's never going to be linked with middle-sized clubs like Southampton until he does well for Rangers.
But I think at the same time, looking at that, you'd say someone like, and coming back to it, on his podcast, he talked about Si Ferry talked about when he left Portsmouth and he went back to Scotland because his missus wanted to go back up the road and had two kids. And it was at that point for him, he said he hated it because what he loved the most about playing in England was you'd be all over the country playing different teams. So he said in a season, there were 24 teams in the Football League that he was in at the time. He would obviously play 23 teams twice. He'd go around the country, he'd play different teams. He said up in Scotland, you've got smaller teams, smaller leagues. You play everyone 3-4 times. So he said he preferred that aspect of that. Now, I think all of a sudden, if you go the other way and you look at some of the players that have played for Celtic and Rangers over the years, and Thomas Gravesen, who signed from Real Madrid, and Henrik Larsson and Neil Lennon, Stylian Petrov, and you think of these greats that have played at Celtic and the other greats that have played at Rangers along the way, all of a sudden, I think these players would say that they signed for the European football. They obviously didn't care about the fact they had to go and play St. Mirren one day and then Livingston the next.
Well, you look at some of those players like they've had in the SPL. They've had, Van Dijk's your obvious example at the moment, isn't he? I guess Tierney coming down at Arsenal now is picking up quite a bit of that. Henrik Larsson went to Barcelona from Celtic. And then went back to Man U. But then looking at some of their great... I mean, Rangers had some decent enough players through the time. Lennon would probably end up falling into some of those categories of being best football. Scott Brown, where would he play his football? He's played centre mid for Celtic for decades and forever and ever been the hard man, the great lad. You look at some of them... who was the lad who Celtic had last year who went for money in the end? Dembele.
And he's at Lyon in the Champions League and he's banging, isn't he?
Yeah. And that's what. So there are players that go there and they'll spend a couple of years and they'll be okay. And then they'll come and be really, really solid players wherever they end up. But there are also some who will be lauded, such as a Scott Brown, as greatest player ever in the Premier League. Not quite that title, but top players, and actually is Championship at best.
I think in a funny way, the one to look at Dembele, and this could be a sign of West Ham's intent, is West Ham are talking about trying to sign Dembele from Lyon. Now, do you look at that and say West Ham are a mid-table team in the Premier League? Maybe they're looking to break into that sort of next bracket with your Leicesters and your Wolves trying to break into the top six by signing him? Or do you look at it and say, there is a player who's left Celtic, very successful, signed for Lyon, played Champions League football, scored however many goals, and is still ending up at a mid-table team in the Premier League? And by that measure, do you then look at someone like Scott Brown and say, hasn't attracted any interest from any other club, really? If he was to step down the Premier League, I personally could see him playing at a... He'd be the hardest bloke in Southwest London at Fulham.
Do you think he plays there, though? Do you think he gets that sort of...
I think he'd strengthen a lower table team's midfield.
Do you think in a Premier League, do you?
Yeah, could I see him break... I mean, you think of Newcastle, who are the bottom end of the mid-table range. Could I see him getting into Newcastle's midfield? We couldn't see him getting above Isaac Hayden.
Mm-hmm.
Could you see him... And there'll be Scottish fans out there who watch him week in, week out who would disagree. But I think Isaac Hayden is probably a better footballer than him, with a better career ahead of him. Would he get in front of, say, someone at Brighton who's in their midfield at the minute? Bissouma? Don't think he'd get in front of Bissouma.
No.
Would he get in front of Barkley, Grealish, McGinn, Douglas Luiz at Villa?
No.
I think there's obviously more money in the Premier League and players go, teams will go out and buy better players.
Does he play alongside like a James McCarthy at Palace? Is he getting ahead of him? Does he?
I could probably see him playing in a Palace.
Yeah.
At a top championship team, a lower. But then it's that debate that if Celtic and Rangers were to drop into the Football League and do what Swansea and Cardiff have done and come and played in the English tiers, where would they settle?
I think they'd be Premier League clubs, because I think they would be such hard places to go and play. I think they'd have decent records at home. And on the same note of, would they attract players if all of a sudden they were in England and they could be mid-level Premier League players? I think they'd still attract more players than they would now, being one of two in Scotland with you. I think they would be... middle of the road, Prem.
I think it would be very similar to how Southampton kind of do. From relegation battle to in the top 10, but never really getting to that next stage of getting into Europe.
If they already ring fence young Scottish talent, I assume, in terms of their academies and things like that. But if they had the English system to play their football in, and presumably their academies and things like that were playing 23s football against Newcastle, West Ham, Man U, 23s and things like that, there'd be no existence for a Dundee, a Livingston, and things like that.
And that's their big day out. That's what attracts the fans and gets.
Yeah.
It's their big paydays. Two games against Celtic and a game against Rangers a year, or vice versa.
Mm-hmm. It's the only thing keeping Scottish football afloat, which is, I presume, on the face of it, the only reason why they haven't actually done it yet, because it's been discussed for years and years as an option, and obviously it hasn't happened. So,
yeah. On another note of European super clubs, Liverpool are getting beat.
They've gone behind, haven't they?
Atalanta have just scored.
It's because they put James Milner in the midfield.
Never let them be there. It'd be the end of the streak, Jim.
No, because they lost to Atletico last year. I think it's in the Premier League, isn't it?
Did Watford beat them at Vicarage Road? I thought Watford beat them at Anfield.
Watford beat them at Vicarage Road. I don't know if it's the Premier League or if it is genuinely all games, because now I think about it, did Atletico beat you or did it...
Was it not extra time?
No, I think it was extra time, but was it not a draw?
Yeah, but Anfield, so as in it doesn't count.
At Madrid?
Yeah.
Yeah, but as in, so at Anfield, it was not...
He's got... he's playing Neco Williams, Reece Williams and the Greek lad with Joel Maddup at the back.
Sektakis or whatever it is. Yeah.
Yeah, as soon as he puts Jota on.
I'll fight Nico win.
Yeah, well, that's just been the Premier League.
Well, what have we just wasted 25 minutes talking about greatest streaks for? The loss last fucking year. Christ.
I'm talking about the greatest.
They're going to lose again.
Right, is that enough for this and we can stop our recording?
I believe so.
Do you want to sign us out, Andrew?
I haven't got an outro. I worked on my intro all week, but James, I'm happy to pass over to you for the outro if you want.
I don't don't really know what to add. Just have a think about what you want to talk about next week. Enjoy your weekend of sports. I might take the Tommy Gravesen approach and have a look at some pool facts for you. Maybe talk a little bit about Ronnie O'Sullivan. I don't really know where I'm going with this. I'm sure I'll find something through the week. There might be an athletic article on it.
He loves the Athletic. It's only a pound. Only a pound at the moment.
Do you reckon we can get them to sponsor us and give us some money? And we'll give them a shout out every week with an article.
Give us your articles to read for our content. And we'll put it in. Yeah, get them in. All right. Goodbye, Gordon.
Bye, Gordon. Right. See you later, Sean.
See you later.